From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. All eyes were on the Greek Parliament Wednesday as it wrangled over the proposed agreement reached between the country's negotiators, led by Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, and the country's European creditors. That deal must clear a series of parliamentary hurdles before it becomes operative. According to the agreement, Greece must first vote to approve the series of mandated cuts and privatizations that were, in essence, rejected in the July 5th referendum by more than 61% of voters. That approval, if it comes, would be followed by votes in the various parliaments of EU members to approve a bailout loan to Greece. Greece's vote was supposed to take place before this Thursday, although as of press time, it was unclear if the vote would happen, after the IMF Tuesday threatened to withdraw support for the bailout unless Greece's European creditors agreed to substantial debt relief for the country. There were anti-austerity marches across Greece, with calls from protesters for the government to reject the agreement. RT's Daniel Hawkins was in Athens Wednesday as the parliament debated the proposal.
And there's a real sense of anger and hostility here towards those EU creditors. Also a sense of betrayal at the Greek government, but certainly it does seem people feel the EU are the real villains in this story. Having spoken to protesters on the ground, there have been some very dramatic words, comparisons to financial fascism, saying that Germany has got a colonial policy towards Greece. People are very unhappy.
This is a package that has no economic policy. It's only to punish the people who voted to elect a left government and they voted for no.
We don't consider the European Union and the Eurozone our home. It is not a home of the people. It is, in fact, an imprisonment for workers' rights.
The issue is the high taxation and the reduction of wages, which also affects me personally, and that there is no future for my children.
So anger on the streets, tension high in Parliament. It's likely to be a long day here in Athens.
But even if Greece approves the terms of the agreement, at least one of the other involved parties, Germany, which is set to vote on Friday, may not. This was Greece's former finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, who is still a Syriza member of Greece's parliament, as he spoke Monday with host Philip Adams on Australia's ABC radio program Late Night Live.
You might have some pleasure in the fact that Merkel's got a few problems with this, because if this manages to get through the Greek parliament, there's no guarantee the German parliament would allow Merkel and Schäuble to start talks on a bailout loan.
Which is amazing, isn't it? We've been asked to effectively humiliate ourselves as a government, to introduce all sorts of bills that run completely against our mandate, on the promise that maybe the Bundestag is going to approve another bailout, which is going to make our debt even more gargantuan than it is, and our economy even less sustainable than it is. It is mind-boggling. I don't think that the European Union has ever made a decision that undermines so fundamentally the project of European integration. It's an outrageous defeat, not for Greece, but for the European project. And it was a defeat again of the European project that was dished out by the European Union. This is going to be remembered by historians in the future in exactly the same way as the Versailles Treaty was in 1919.
Many have argued that Greece's weapon in the negotiations was the threat of a withdrawal from the Eurozone, the so-called Grexit. But the majority of Greeks favor remaining in the Eurozone, and the government has committed to it, even threatening to sue in the event of a move by its creditors to force such an event. Varoufakis explained the contradictions that his government faced in preparations for a Grexit.
As a responsible government, knowing full well that there was a very significant alliance within the Eurogroup whose purpose was to throw us out of the Euro, we had to make contingencies. We had to have a team, small team of people, in secret, who would create the plan in case we were forced, not in case we chose, but in case we were forced to exit the monetary union known as the Eurozone. Now, of course, you realize that there is a conundrum here. Once this plan begins to get implemented, that is, you go from five people who are working on it to 500, which is the minimum you need in order to implement it, then it becomes public knowledge. The moment it becomes public knowledge, the power of prophecy creates a dynamic of its own, and then you're out of the euro before you realize it. We never made that transition from 5 to 500. We never felt we had a mandate to do this. We would never plan to do it. We had the, you know, the design on paper, but it was never activated.
Yanis, the Economist at the weekend argued for a temporary Grexit. If the Europeans allowed the Greeks to issue scrip or temporarily to introduce an emergency parallel currency, Greece might in effect suspend its membership of the single currency without technically leaving. A fantasy?
Well, if it is a fantasy, it's also Dr. Schäuble's fantasy, because this is precisely what he proposed to me. This is what he proposed to me in a number of meetings we had. He proposed, he called it time out. It's his expression. For us, it was a fantasy. The moment you begin the deconstruction of a monetary union, you are unleashing powers that you cannot control. And it takes incredible folly to think that you can control them. And this is why we rejected the proposal. It's a proposal that we would never have accepted as committed Europeanists. We believed that setting aside the very significant costs for the Greek social economy, that this kind of plotting, this kind of stratagems are part of the process of killing off European integration. And it's an outrageous defeat of the European project, as I said before.
But rather than fearing a Grexit, one important figure in the negotiations, Germany's finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, had, according to Varoufakis, been using his country's position to try to force one.
Dr. Schäuble wants Grexit. He has been planning for it. He considered it to be an essential aspect of his plan for Europe, for a kind of political union that is now missing. A very specific kind of union, a disciplinarian one, one that is not a federation, but one that is based on the capacity of a single fiscal overlord to veto national budgets and therefore to annul national sovereignty. And he thinks that Grexit was essential for this, because a Grexit would create the fear in the minds and hearts of French and Italian politicians in particular to force them to acquiesce to the Schäuble plan.
So you're saying that Greece is simply a pawn on the board?
Well, it is. So what we have here is a major clash of titans between Dr. Schäuble on the one hand and Paris and Rome on the other. The Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has not committed one way or the other. And Dr. Schäuble, who's been around for a very long time, he's been here in the center of the Euro project from its inception. He's not happy with the way that the monetary union was not accompanied by a political union. He would probably like to have a federation, but he feels that he doesn't have the political power to create one. So he is going for what he considers to be, not me, what he considers to be the second best, which must, in his mind, involve a Grexit that will inspire sufficient fear in Paris and Rome, and possibly in Berlin too, in order to bring about that disciplinarian negative political union. Negative in the sense that the overlord, the equivalent of the federal treasurer, will only have negative powers, powers to veto national budgets, but not creative powers, powers to transfer surpluses and to do a Marshall Plan, let's say. And the reason why I'm saying all this, Philip, is not because I have a theory. It's because Dr. Schäuble has told me so.
Varoufakis compared his country's situation with the 1967 U.S.-backed coup there that placed a military junta in power for most of the next 10 years.
You've been around long enough to remember the 1967 coup d'etat. You will recall that the choice of weapon used in order to bring down democracy then was the tanks. Well, this time it was the banks. The banks were used by foreign powers to take over the government. In 67, they used the tanks to take over the government. The difference is now that this time they're also taking over all remaining public property. They're putting it in a company that is going to be domiciled in Luxembourg. Remember LuxLeaks? The Greek government is going to have to sell all of it according to a specified timetable, give 50% of it back to the Troika for repaying unpayable debt, use another part of it to recapitalize the banks without ever having any control over the banks. So the banks remain completely under the control of the oligarchs who brought the country to its knees a few years ago. And only what if and when a few euros remain from these sales, and I can assure you that they won't, because the projected prices are just outrageously high. If that is not, that turns out to be untrue and a little bit of money is left, that money is going to go into some kind of public investment, but there will be none left. So this is, how shall I put it? You're right, it's a complete annulment of national sovereignty.
You've got some pretty good turns of phrases, you know, tanks and banks. You've also come up with the notion of economic asphyxiation. Now, this asphyxiation has been going on steadily for almost 5 years.
That is correct. I call it something else too. You remember I used the term, which I think you liked a couple of years ago, fiscal waterboarding. So imagine that the Greek government's head is submerged in water, CIA-like, and then the moment it's about to perish, to die, you know, it's allowed to come up for a gasp of air and push back in the water of fiscal austerity. This is done in a variety of ways, but what is going to follow in the next few weeks and months is going to be a far worse version of fiscal waterboarding, Philip.
While Athens has pushed aggressively for creditors to write down the country's debt, which now exceeds 300 billion euros, the three members of the Troika, the EU, the European Central Bank, and the IMF, have thus far refused. But without such relief, the Greek government has argued, the debt will remain a heavy weight on Greece's economy. That position was confirmed in an IMF report that was leaked in advance of last weekend's marathon negotiating session, but was only made available to the public Tuesday. In it, the IMF itself said that the debt was unsustainable and was damaging Greece's economy. The report proposed that creditors let Athens write off part of its huge debt and or extend its repayment plan for 30 years. According to the IMF report, Greece would have to spend 15% of its GDP annually to sustain the debt payments to European creditors. Dr. Richard Wellings is Deputy Editorial Director at the Institute of Economic Affairs in the UK. He spoke with RT's Katie Pilbeam from London Wednesday.
The IMF has come through and injected a cold dose of much-needed economic reality into the bailout discussions. And of course, this EU bailout is based on some very optimistic assumptions about the kind of reforms Greece can implement on Greek economic growth over the next 2 or 3 years and big increases in employment and so on. They're completely unrealistic. And let's be honest, given Greece's fundamental economic problems, it's highly unlikely that this debt's ever going to be paid off completely. So some kind of default or renegotiation is absolutely necessary, as the IMF is now pointing out.
Well, considering the IMF is such a well-esteemed, well-respected institute, do you think that now that it has come out and made this statement, that perhaps some of the details in this plan might be changed?
I think that's right, because I think it's really essential that the EU gets the IMF on board. And this is extremely unusual. Usually the EU and the IMF are singing from the same hymn sheet. So this suggests a deep split within the EU and transnational elites. I think it probably reflects, if you like, the Germans wanting to make an example out of Greece to try and deter any defiance in Spain and Italy, whereas the IMF has a much bigger influence from the United States. And of course, they're more concerned about the geopolitical considerations. They want to keep Greece within the Western European fold. They don't want it to look elsewhere to, say, Russia or China. So there are competing incentives here. Germans concerned about their own domestic vote, and the US far more concerned about the geopolitics and therefore prepared to take a softer line with Greece.
Well, you mentioned the US and Germany there, but just want to talk about the UK as well, because the UK Prime Minister has called for debt relief for Greece, but at the same time, David Cameron, he doesn't want to play any part in this bailout, and the UK isn't actually alone either, as you say, really. So does that surprise you?
Not really. Of course, any UK contribution to the bailout is going to play into the hands of the Eurosceptics. And we've already seen a massive increase in Euroscepticism in the UK in response to this Greek crisis, particularly on the left, not the traditional people who are more conservative. So this is obviously very worrying for the EU and David Cameron. But no matter what David Cameron says, the UK is almost inevitably going to be drawn into this bailout and face a cost of probably a few billion, either through the IMF's involvement, which the UK has to contribute to, or via some of these EU bailout mechanisms that are authorised through a majority vote, so the UK can't actually block their involvement in this.
And, OK, let's go back to Germany then, shall we? Because the deal is also unpopular in Germany, where the people don't actually believe that Greece will pay this money back. Do you think that it will pass in the Bundestag then?
I think it will, and that's because there's a big cleavage between the German people and the German political elite. And the German political elite are far more committed to the European centralisation project, and they'll do anything to keep it going, at least for the time being, whereas the population are far more Eurosceptic. You know, they've seen bailout after bailout, and it also sets, none of them have worked, and it also sets a very dangerous precedent looking ahead towards, Spain and Italy, which could be even, a different league to Greece, a far more expensive proposition looking at the long-term future. So obviously German voters are extremely annoyed about this, and therefore Chancellor Merkel has to make a very, very difficult balancing act here. It's very hard for her indeed.
Meanwhile, an independent expert from the UN said that perhaps a bailout deal was needed to avoid a larger crisis, but that Greece needs to choose its reforms with care lest they run counter to international human rights law. Daniel Johnson filed this report from the United Nations.
While the Greek parliament debates the austerity measures its international creditors expect to see before handing over a $95 billion bailout, a leading human rights expert has warned of serious potential pitfalls. Juan Pablo Bohoslavsky, a UN independent expert on the rights impact of foreign debt, said he hoped the deal on the table will avoid a larger crisis in Greece. But he insisted that any further reforms must respect what he called people's core rights to healthcare, food and social security. And the independent expert underlined the real legal risk that some austerity measures could be incompatible with international rights law. Bohoslavsky also expressed concern about reports of shortages of medicines and food in Greece. In future crisis situations, the UN independent expert said it would make much more sense to assess loan repayments based on sustainable development issues rather than, as he put it, a narrow financial perspective. That would help to ensure the protection of the environment, human rights and social development, he said. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
Here in the US, the program of austerity may not go by that name, but it is nevertheless being felt in many parts of the country, most notoriously among them in the city of Detroit, as Abba Yemi Ezekwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, told Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
What's really interesting about Greece, and what's interesting about Puerto Rico as well, is that it mirrors what has taken place here in the city of Detroit. The attacks on pensions, the designation and the claim that the people there owe billions upon billions of dollars to the banks and the bond rating agencies, in fact, rubber stamping those claims. So this is the struggle of modern capitalism. I don't think it's strictly isolated to Greece or to Puerto Rico. It's a process that is taking place internationally. And I think it represents the decline of the current economic system, world economic system. And until people are organized, until they're mobilized, until they have a vision for a new system, this is going to continue. If you look at Greece, they went after the pension. They've been attacking the whole notion of a social contract or a social network. We see the same situation in Puerto Rico. They have to change the law in order to provide a pseudo-legal rationale for them to be put into bankruptcy, as they did in the city of Detroit. They've even brought Stephen Rhodes, they brought him to Puerto Rico as a consultant. Now, he was the federal judge that oversaw the Detroit bankruptcy and restructuring. So it's the same process that's going on. And for people who think that they're lucky that they don't live in Detroit, that they don't live in Greece, that they don't live in Puerto Rico. This is coming to their city as well.
And we'll have more on that tomorrow. South Korea is apparently breaking ranks with the U.S. with a new offer of talks with the North without preconditions. As Washington pursues stiffer sanctions against Pyongyang, Seoul has reduced restrictions on inter-Korean cooperation and exchange. Press TV's Frank Smith reports.
South Korea takes the initiative for engagement with North Korea as Seoul reduces restrictions on civilian inter-Korean relations and drops preconditions on talks with Pyongyang.
As we express in our active encouragement of private-level exchanges and offer of official dialogue, the government position is that even before the denuclearization of North Korea, we can start cooperation and exchange projects in order to lay the foundation for peaceful unification and restore the family bond of the North and South Korean peoples.
About 250 South Koreans today depart on a railway journey across Asia to Europe, but they fly over North Korea. The government strongly supports the construction of a railway through the North, which would link up the two Koreas with all of Eurasia. Officials are hopeful such projects can encourage inter-Korean détente. But the United States is moving in the opposite direction, with a U.S. Senate proposal to strengthen sanctions against North Korea.
Inter-Korean relations and North Korea-U.S. relations need a virtuous cycle to create the atmosphere for peaceful reunification. However, the Park Geun-hye administration wants to talk to the North, while the U.S. Senate and Obama administration are strengthening sanctions towards Pyongyang. Such offsetting actions between Seoul and Washington will never help inter-Korean relations.
Meanwhile, production at the two Koreas' joint factory park has doubled in 2 years as Seoul and Pyongyang enter wage talks. Similar civilian events planned include an orchestral performance in the DMZ and a visit to North Korea by the widow of former President Kim Dae-jung.
The initiatives currently in progress are cause for optimism for relations between North Korea and South Korea. However, for Pyongyang's lasting integration into the international community, wider negotiations and U.S. compromise are necessary. Frank Smith, Press TV, Seoul.
Saudi Arabia continues to pound Yemen with airstrikes. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
Saudi Arabia has intensified its deadly airstrikes against Yemen, conducting over 200 airstrikes on Tuesday. Saudi fighter jets have conducted more than 100 airstrikes on different areas in Hajj and Sa'dah provinces. At least 8 Yemeni people were killed after an air raid targeted a residential area in the Harad district in Hajj. The southern province of Aden was also pounded over 100 times. The city of Taiz was targeted by Saudi warplanes as well, with casualties reported. Meanwhile, Yemeni media say that Ansarullah fighters and popular committees have taken control of the Aden airport. The attacks come despite a UN-brokered ceasefire, which went into effect on Friday night.
Tuesday's announcement of a deal between the P5+1 countries and Iran was met with mixed reaction around the world, with Israel and Saudi Arabia, along with many in the U.S. Congress and among the group of declared and likely presidential candidates, telling tales of gloom and doom, while others were talking about a Nobel Peace Prize for the plan's architects. Press TV's Sheena Sharani has more.
Reactions are pouring in after the conclusion of nuclear talks between Iran and the P5+1 group of countries. European leaders welcome the Vienna developments as a historic opportunity that ends over a decade of dispute between Iran and the West. The European Union's foreign policy chief also expressed hope that the conclusion of nuclear negotiations would help Iran and the international community build a new relationship.
It would be a game changer, a real game changer, if we manage to build trust and on this trust that we might build, also build the possibility of working together to solve some of the major conflicts we have in the region. And this will allow, hopefully, to open the way for a different kind of relationship between Iran and the international community and also in the region. This is an enormous historic opportunity for changing the nature of our relationship.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the deal paves the way for a broad coalition to fight ISIL terrorists. His remarks were echoed by Iraqi Prime Minister, who said the nuclear deal will be a catalyst for regional stability and will lead to better unity in the fight against terrorism. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has also hailed the outcome of the talks as a great victory. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon said the deal could restore peace to the Middle East.
I hope and indeed believe that this agreement will lead to greater mutual understanding and cooperation on the many serious security challenges in the Middle East. As such, it could serve as a vital contribution to peace and stability both in the region and beyond.
Some regional countries have also reacted positively. The United Arab Emirates said the deal could turn a new page in the region. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said the transparent implementation of the deal would benefit Turkey. But the conclusion of the talks have dealt a heavy blow to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, leaving him at odds with the international community. In a phone call, US President Barack Obama tried to reassure Netanyahu that Washington is still committed to supporting Israel. Obama said the deal will prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear-armed state, which is in the interests of both Washington and Tel Aviv. Earlier, Netanyahu had described the developments in Vienna as a historic mistake.
What a stunning historic mistake. Israel is not bound by this deal with Iran, and Israel is not bound by this deal with Iran because Iran continues to seek our destruction. We will always defend ourselves.
Netanyahu claimed the nuclear deal would give Iran, quote, a sure path to nuclear weapons, as many of the restrictions against Tehran would be lifted. His remarks were slammed by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
The fact is that he's practically been making comments that are way over the top. He doesn't even know what the concessions are that we have not engaged in, because we haven't made concessions. So there's a game here, you know, there's a process here. This is under attack by people who really don't know the terms of the agreement.
There was also skepticism in the U.S. Congress over Iran's nuclear deal, with some congressmen saying they're prepared to reject the deal because it does not comprehensively halt Tehran's enrichment process or guarantee intrusive inspections. The U.S. House Speaker warned the White House that the Republicans will block a nuclear deal with Iran if they think it's not a good one.
The deal that we have out there, in my view, from what I know of it thus far, is unacceptable. It's going to hand a dangerous regime billions of dollars in sanctions relief while paving the way for a nuclear Iran. And we're going to do everything we can to get to the details. If in fact it's as bad a deal as I think it is at this moment, we'll do everything we can to stop it.
While Congress may have enough votes to pass a resolution of disapproval, the two-thirds majority required to overturn President Obama's promised veto is very unlikely.
Meanwhile, there are still issues to be worked out as the deal is implemented, as Robert Kelly, a former official at the International Atomic Energy Agency, told RT.
IAEA could go on fishing expeditions and act as an intelligence agency for other people. I don't think Iran is going to allow that. And also, I think you have to kind of wonder about that word suspicious. It's appeared in a number of press releases in the last year. What's a suspicious facility? Facilities are usually not suspicious. They don't suspect. So you're in a position of saying it's in the eye of the beholder. The IAEA will have no problem at all monitoring uranium materials, the production of uranium, the chemistry. That'll be easy. The problem will come when IAEA is asked to look into things like high explosives, detonators, missiles, things like that, where they have no expertise and they have no historical mandate. For the last 50 years, they haven't done those things. And so for them to suddenly become experts in those areas, I think is impossible.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.